This is the 1 Million Lives Podcast by Laramie. Listen to healthcare professionals, healthcare educators, and survivors share their best practices and what they've learned from these experiences. At Laerdal, it's our goal to help save 1 million more lives every year by 2030. One life at a time.
I would like to welcome Dr. Libby Thomas to the 1 Million Live podcast here at Laerdal. Dr. Libby Thomas is a consultant in emergency medicine at King's College Hospital in London. She's got a PhD in medical education and simulation, and she also works as a senior clinical lecturer at Queen Mary University in London. The reason why we have invited Dr. Libby Thomas here today is because of her participation in the team that early took responsibility to try to prepare the hospital for the big unknown fear or the big unknown virus, COVID-19, or the coronavirus, as it was called then, that was underway. There were very, very scary pictures and stories coming out from Italy, from the Lombardia region. And this sent shivers throughout the spine of medical personnel all over the world, including in London. So, Dr. Libby Thomas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Tell me a little about, what do you remember from the absolutely beginning when you heard about the coronavirus, as we called it at that time?
Well, I don't know if we would count ourselves as the lucky ones, but we had quite a few early cases after the sort of instances in Europe with outbreaks in ski resorts and things like that and people coming back. So we instigated some quite early testing coming through our local area and trying to just get to grips with those sorts of protocols and how we manage that in those first stages. And then as the wave started to come into the UK, we recognised that we had increasing number of cases happening across South London. And we really seemed to be the canaries in the mine potentially for what was going to happen. So it was uncharted territory to a degree as to how the UK hospitals were responding to this. But it was also a blank canvas, which can be seen as an opportunity as well as a threat.
You mentioned the canary in the mines. For those who are not familiar with that expression, the coal miners working in the numbers of thousands of coal mines all over UK, they were very afraid of the oxygen level in the mines. So they tended to bring a canary in a small cage. And if the canary stopped singing or basically died, they just legged it and run out of the mines to save their own life. A good picture of the situation at that time.
Yes, I think it was to a degree. I think we knew it was going to be challenging, and we had the, as you said, the content coming from Lombardy and hearing what was happening in Italy. And we listened closely to our colleagues in Italy and listened to very excellent conversations with them through the St. Emmeline's podcast, which is a great free open access medical education podcast run in the UK. And it certainly got us all concerned about what the potential implications could be.
So you work in emergency medicine. So how did you yourself become involved in the COVID cases and further on the planning on how you should be allowed or enabled to receive more? Because I guess at some stage you started to get an idea that there could be a lot of patients coming in.
Yeah, I think actually where my role really came in was thinking about how we develop protocols and manage this new situation. Taking it way back before we had a real idea of the numbers, actually we had the initial challenges of PPE, which people didn't know how to put on and take off appropriately for a virus that we still did not understand how it was transmitted. and we didn't understand the basic implications and how this was going to work in practice. So if we were going to do an aerosol generating procedure and intubate somebody in our resus department, or if we were going to transfer somebody through the hospital who we thought or knew had coronavirus, how we had to do that safely to get them to critical care or to where they were going to have definitive treatment. So my involvement was really at these very early stages of thinking and using simulation to think about how we could create these protocols and these processes, and also how we could start to do some upscaling of the education to get our own staff ready. So luckily we work closely across different departments, especially with the critical care colleagues. And so it really started with a few of us from emergency medicine and from critical care and from the education simulation fellows coming together and thinking, problematizing, really going back to a learning needs analysis. And what was it we had to work out how to do, and how were we going to train people to do this and to train them pretty rapidly?
I was thinking, as there were so many unknowns, so many unknown factors with the coronavirus. Let's call it that, as that's what we used to call it, at least in the beginning. And people didn't really understand how little or much it took for themselves to be infected. Doctors and nurses, I guess they were as scared as everyone. It brings back memories when I was a young nurse myself, and we started to get AIDS patients in. And of course, today we know much more. But then we were so afraid, you know, to be in the same room, because, you know, this was a situation or an illness with no treatment and with a certain death as the only outcome. And we didn't know if this was the same case with the coronavirus, right?
Exactly. And this is where it became really important, because what's interesting from the simulation community is historically a lot of comparisons have been made to aviation. And I've always talked about how actually you can't compare them, because in aviation, the pilot also has his life or her life at risk. If the plane goes down, then they don't expect to survive as well. In healthcare simulation, up until this coronavirus, or occasionally when we maybe did some simulation around viral hemorrhagic fever, such as Ebola, we didn't expect our own lives to be at risk. And suddenly this was a real change in the psyche and creating a fear, and a real fear either for yourself or for taking it home to your family. And to your loved ones and the community. And so it was a very different, it made debriefing tricky. It's a very different approach, and different cautions had to be taken.
So how did you go about to set up this? So I understand you set up a sort of like a system to ensure that the right people were trained first. I also assume that some of the groups you invited in to these simulation sessions were not really that used to using simulation as a training tool either.
So what we did is initially we used simulation room to just practice protocols and to work out actually if we were going to intubate somebody, who was going to get changed into their PPE, who was going to be inside the room, who was going to be outside the room, what kit needed to be in there, what needed to be out, and recreate the protocol from there. And we also used it to simulate how we would do a cardiac arrest, because the guidance was changing. And obviously we were being advised to go away from a cardiac arrest, put on PPE before returning and continuing CPR and considering airway maneuvers and everything else. And we actually recorded a video to try and explain that to people and to show them the process and walk them through it. And then what we also did was set up a sort of quite an informal simulation running three times a day in one of our, effectively a coffee room, but it was within the hospital, where we could start running through scenarios and thinking about mainly the aerosol generating procedures and the transfer of patients. And thinking about how the team was needed, how the team should be distributed, how you used kit, and all those different elements. And that was very open invitation, but it was directed mainly at the emergency and the critical care departments. What was key to us is that it was drop in, drop out. There was no like formal sign up needed. So sometimes you'd have 10 people, sometimes you could have 30 people before we really understood about social distancing. And that was, it was interesting because you had this sort of rolling rota of people coming through, and it was just about giving people a bit of exposure. You had to balance that exposure and that education and talking about systems with also the fear and the chance to debrief and discuss what people's concerns were and their risks. So we did do things quite differently to how we would normally. And we ran much more of a stop-start simulation style. So what do we see happening now? Doing a bit of commentary, asking for audience participation. And it was all done in an open environment. It wasn't in a simulation suite per se. So actually there was no barrier between the simulation and the audience. So they could all hear each other and all be involved in the conversations. But yeah, anybody was welcome to come to it. And we took constant feedback and tried to develop and improve.
What kind of tools did you use?
So we did have a simulator. We had a mannequin, and we had we had a simulation trolley with all the intubation kit and things like that. But we very quickly realized that we already had shortages of PPE. And so I had simple things that I had some mask, surgical masks that said FFP3 on it and others that didn't. We had different colored simple aprons. But it, if you were wearing a red apron, it meant you were wearing a full long sleeve waterproof protective gown. And if you were only wearing a white apron, then that's all it was equivalent to. And just trying to be simple in those sorts of manners to try and conserve supplies at that stage, because that was really key to us, that we certainly didn't want to be putting anything at risk in the clinical sphere if we didn't have those supplies available.
You're listening to 1 Million Lives, a Laerdal podcast.
Yeah, supplies was a big issue for most countries. Absolutely, I remember that very well. So you also had the situation where we knew or assumed that there would be a much more need for intensive care treatment than many or most hospitals were really built for. And there also, so equipment was, of course, one issue. Another issue was people to treat these patients. And I assume you also had the same situations with both doctors and nurses who had to be trained to do another job than what they were really used to, getting doctors up to speed to manage mechanical ventilators and nurses as well. Did you also experience this at your hospital?
I mean, certainly this was a challenge across the whole of the health service, National Health Service in the UK. And we really didn't know how each hospital would be able to respond and how they'd be able to expand their capacity. And this is significant beyond my role with it in my trust as what I was doing. But I have a sort of a wider picture of it from work I went on to do as I transitioned out of working in the trust to working for the Nightingale Hospital that we set up in East London, and then involved in more pan-London work over the following sort of year to 18 months. So as we went into surges 2, 3, and 4. So I have a view of that. So to comment on that from a wider perspective and my position there rather than my consultant role, certainly we didn't know how each trust was going to be able to respond in advance, and people had to think about how they would manage that and how they would recruit and retain and move staff in order to be able to cover the areas that they needed covered. And all I can say was that it was phenomenal, the response that was achieved and the way that trusts managed to expand their critical care numbers way beyond what anybody thought was possible initially. Which was fantastic. And there was a lot of lessons learned about where you should have critical care patients and about, you know, the positives and negatives of setting up field hospitals effectively in order for patients. And I think the thing that we really learned was that what seemed to come across from the initial conversations with Lombardy was that potentially this was a very isolated respiratory disease And as we all know, it turned out to be a far more complicated disease than that, requiring multi-organ support and things, which therefore required much more complex systems in order to manage those patients.
So how did your colleagues take this? Many of them, I guess, you know, there are always those who are eager to participate in use simulation as a training tool. But I guess you also involved people that were not really that used to use simulation so much as a training tool. How did they take this? This was brand new for them, not just the disease, but the way of learning.
So what was interesting is we took this sort of three times a day setup that we were doing in this slightly makeshift setup, and we moved it into a slightly more formal place where we had a much larger space and we could invite much larger numbers. And this was sort of 10 days, probably 2 weeks into the whole process. And there was this real realization that redeployment was probably going to happen. But actually, the knowledge people needed was how to don and doff PPE, how to go in and out of rooms, how to do simple things like transfer and help. And so actually what we did was set up much bigger sort of viewing simulations where we ran through scenarios with audiences of maybe 50 plus people present. And that was great. We had people coming from the Dental Institute, you know, dental nurses and dentists. We had people coming from all over the hospital who just wanted to get a basic idea, to see something practical, something vaguely experiential rather than just reading, because we were all addicted to our phones, weren't we? Reading the latest guidance, reading the latest things. But it was challenging because our hospital had gone into a command system, a major incident command system, as many did. And everything was changing. What the guidance that was coming out from the government was changing day by day. Therefore, the hospital guidance was changing day by day. And we were teaching, we were saying, well, this is correct today, but it may not be correct tomorrow. So you need to check what the latest kit is then, or what you're meant to be doing at that stage. But what was interesting for me in terms of disseminating the learning as well is we tried to promote something called close to situation simulation. So rather than doing full in situ simulation, which wasn't sensible given what was going on, is actually we tried to disseminate the learning to the different departments. So a close colleague in renal medicine was like, actually, can we do some of this training for our staff? And by taking the simulation to their seminar room and being close to their ward, we could bring more staff into the training. We could do it around a specific patient for their patient group. We could think about their particular group challenges. We could think about, you know, if the patient was on dialysis or whatever else the additional complication might be. And then as a ward and as a group, they could take that learning back and go in and review their systems. They could review where they were storing kit, how they were going to respond to a certain situation. And that was quite rewarding to do that. And we got invited to various places across the trust to do it and to try and disseminate that learning in that way. And then actually to continue that further, we started doing a sort of a loan scheme so people could borrow a set of kit to take and run their own sessions, so they didn't need us to be there to facilitate it. And they could borrow a basic mannequin and some basic airway kit or whatever else it might be that they needed to run those simulations. But we also supplied them guidance, how to do the debriefs, what questions to ask, what were the challenges for their local system, what were their challenges for their local protocols, what were the challenges for the staff responding, how did people feel about this? And so it could start to really open up those local conversations, which was really nice. And I found that very rewarding to sort of think about how we empowered new groups. And that's when we really started to expose the people who maybe didn't normally engage, because that's when you would get the cleaners coming to join in, or the porters, or whoever else it might be locally to that area. So the team was interprofessional in the truest sense. And I'm a big advocate for interprofessional education and feel that simulation is really the best place where we should be advocating for this.
You think that this simulation sessions that you were running across different professions in the hospital, they were all in it together. They had different tasks, but they all got their training on what they needed to do. So
Anecdotally, yes. I don't have the hard evidence to back that up.
Of course. Of course. But you had a, I must say that, you know, I was outside the hospital at that time. It looked for me that, you know, you said that everybody was watching or reading from their mobile phones in horror what was happening and trying to figure out what they were going to do. And the simulation sessions and the training, that was something concrete. Something was actually happening. Right. And that was a comforting element in itself.
And it's that lack of, when people can't visualize something, then it's hard to process it sometimes. And so the simulation brings that visualization, it brings that experimentation in, it brings that experience in, you know, and all those elements. But actually, if you can do it together with the groups, you can say, you know, my consultant colleagues be like, right, well, how are we going to solve this problem on our board space? How are we going to make this work for us? And they're not stuck in a generic group with lots of people fighting for, well, we've got this problem here, we've got that problem there. They're actually thinking about their very local community. Then that's empowering, and it provides a good glue.
What did we learn so that we are better next time? And how can we ensure that the knowledge, the learnings of this are shared?
Well, we've learned so much in so many different ways, haven't we? And what's been fascinating is the evolution of this virus and the way it has changed our need to respond. I think something we were acutely aware of at the beginning, though, was the impact it was going to have on people. And we knew there was that fear of it, but we didn't realize, or maybe I think we did realize, but actually the long-term moral injury that has happened as a result of this has been actually what's our biggest learning, the effect on the workforce. And if we don't have a psychologically healthy workforce, then we struggle to carry on to deliver. So I've done some work subsequently on sort of moral injury and what the impact of that is. And I think that's really fascinating about how people had no control. They had no control over the virus. They had no control over what they were expected to do because we were being told by central government, because we were trying to respond in the moment, because it was all unknowns. And actually, I think that going forward is how do we give that control? How do we allow people to have autonomy? And how do we allow people to have that personal agency? And therefore, you can actually have a better, longer-term outcome. So I think actually a lot of it's personnel-related as much as it is about healthcare systems in terms of policy or in terms of how we put PPE on and off.
You are the co-author of a paper on what you did to prepare the hospital for the coming COVID crisis, together with Peter Dickman and Sigrun Kvindesland and a few others. But what more is happening? So what more is ongoing now to ensure that the learnings are spread globally? You mentioned something with the World Health Organization.
Yeah, so I've been invited to be part of an expert group developing WHO guidance on learning and capacity building in health emergencies. So they're really trying to think about not just something like coronavirus. I mean, health emergencies take so many forms across the world, but how do we bring this learning together? And I think something that COVID really highlighted was the way the world can now connect. Within that first week, I was on a WhatsApp group of global simulation experts, which somebody invited me onto. And it was amazing. There was over 350 people from around the world on WhatsApp. And I was sharing my scenarios and people were sharing their scenarios and their videos and what they were doing and how they were adapting their training. And the fact that we have this global community that can now digitally connect, how do we capitalize that? And sometimes we can see that more easily in the first world, but actually in the developing countries and those, you know, who have less resources, how can we also help them to learn from what we've all learned and how can we take that forwards? And I think that's really, really important. So I think what is key, and as an educationist, is we shouldn't lose these lessons lost, these lessons learned. Sorry, we shouldn't lose these lessons that we've learned, but we need to actually bring them together and make sure we build on it and we share it. So it's not happened in silos. I hate nothing worse than people, we describe it as reinventing the wheel. You know, the wheel's there, use the wheel. Why would you try starting again to see if a square or a triangle was better? You know, and likewise, I was like, here's my simulation scenarios, take them, use them. I don't want other people to write them, but also take our lessons learned, take our ways of doing things differently. And it may or may not work for what you do, but try it, simulate it, see if it's going to happen. And actually, we have such a global community of expertise now that I feel we can all draw on that and learn together, then we really are starting to make some positive benefits.
Thank you very much, Dr. Libby Thomas, for this very interesting insight into the dramatic first days and weeks and months of the corona, later called COVID-19 pandemic, and how it all panned out.
I just want to say I'm a small part in a really big wheel, and you know, it's the team that makes these things happen and working collaboratively together, and only by doing that that things can go forward. So I need to thank all my colleagues who I worked with.
Oh yes, of course, this is a team job if nothing else.
You have been listening to a 1 Million Lives podcast by Laerdal. You can find all our podcasts and access any bonus material on laerdal.com/podcast. The views, information, or opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of the institution they are affiliated with or of Laerdal Medical. If you have any suggestions for guests or topics we should cover, please send us a message on laerdal.com/podcast. We look forward to hearing from you.
Until the next time. Goodbye from the Laerdal podcast team.